Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is the Shame-Free Zone. I'm your host, Veronica Monet. I'm really excited about tonight's interview. I'm getting to interview one of my favorite authors, Howard Bloom. Howard Bloom's got a very unique brain, and I enjoy reading what comes out of it. He had a book called The Lucifer Principle, which I became a huge fan of when it came out. He's got a new book now, and it's called The God Problem. And incidentally, I wrote about God just today. If you get my newsletter, you know that. And Howard and I are probably going to discuss that as well. But let me tell you a little bit more about Howard Bloom in case you haven't heard of him. He helped to build or sustain the careers of quite a few pop stars. Now, he actually had an opportunity, had fellowships in psychology and neurobiology, but decided not to do that. He decided he wanted to investigate popular culture in a scientific method, and he really perfected his approach to it. So he helped people like Prince, Michael Jackson, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, Billy Joel, Paul Simon, Billy Idol, Peter Gabriel, David Byrne, John Mellencamp, Queen, Kiss, Aerosmith, AC/DC, Grandmaster Flash, The Furious Five, Run DMC, and about 100 other artists. So if you like music, you probably have in some way benefited from Howard Bloom's genius. He also helped launch Farm Aid and Amnesty International's American Presence, and he worked with the United Negro College Fund, the National Black United Fund, and the NAACP, and he put together the first public service radio campaign for solar power in 1981. Today, his focus group on behavior extends to geopolitics. Howard Bloom, it's a pleasure to have you here at the Shame-Free Zone. Thank you for joining me.
Well, Veronica, I've been following you. You've been I've been on your mailing list for a long, long time, and you are a courageous woman, and you take a very vital part of human life, something that we normally, whose importance we really normally do not see, and whose potential we really normally do not see, and that's sex. And sex is at the heart of evolutionary biology, and it gets very close to the creative engines of the cosmos.
Precisely. And I was going to say something to our listeners about that. As a matter of fact, that if they thought we weren't talking about sex tonight, I disagree. Because it's exactly what is it that's driving the universe if it isn't sex?
But the universe is this very peculiar place, and it does seem to be driven, and it does seem to be motivated, and it does seem to have this urge to push forward no matter what. And it does seem to have this urge to create both variety and sameness. And sex is a part of that. I mean, sex is only roughly 800 million, possibly 550 million years old in a universe that's 13.72 billion years old, but it fits the themes that the universe has been playing out ever since the Big Bang.
Well, and, you know, you've got some interesting takes on what it is that drives the universe as far as creativity. One of the things in reading your book, The God Problem, one of the things that really jumped out for me was the fact that you are kind of saying that math and logic do not really help us assess the universe, that math and logic are somehow limited, and maybe some kind of symbolic shorthand for the way the human brain works, but not necessarily an accurate model of how the universe works. Could you say more about that?
Well, yeah, actually, the human brain is very much like a computer. It's not like a computer. It's much more sophisticated and interesting than a computer. But it's like a computer in the following sense. you can take a computer and give it only one program, a program to play tic-tac-toe, and you can conclude that your program is a dummy. All it can do is play tic-tac-toe. But you can give your program a more advanced, or your computer a more advanced piece of software, a software that allows it to do, let's say, word processing, and all of a sudden your computer's capable of all kinds of things it wasn't capable of before. So humanity, the human brain, is like that too. It's just that decade after decade, generation after generation, we keep refining the software with which we make our brains smart. And right now, it turns out, look, I had a big question, Veronica. I use logic a lot because I've been in science since I was 10 years old. You know, that I got started in science and microbiology and theoretical physics at the age of 10 and built my first Boolean algebra machine at the age of 12 and co-conceived a computer that won a bunch of prizes back then and then worked at the world's largest cancer research facility when I was 16. And you can't spend a life in science without taking logic and reason very seriously. But logic and reason, over the last 10 years, I began to wonder, what is logic? What is reason? People talk about them all the time as if they are somehow exalted. But nobody ever says what they are. So in this book, I went back to trace the roots of the logic and reason that we use every day and discovered it all went back to Aristotle. It's 2,300 years old. Now, the big problem is this, because we don't ask the question, what is logic, and we don't ask the question, what is reason, we don't question these things, and we don't question their limitations, and their limitations are severe. They just don't fit this universe. We've got a universe, okay, if you and I were sitting at a cafe table before the beginning of the universe, and you were the visionary and I was the crusty old fart, and we'd been there forever because there's no time and there's no space, there's no nothing. Before there's a universe. And one day, after we've been there, after we've had millions of cups of coffee, you get a bright idea, and you say, look, over there, of course, there is no over there, Veronica, but we'll pretend there is. Look, okay. Over there, any second now, there's going to be a pinprick, infinitely, decimally smaller than a pinprick, and it is going to explode with time, space, and energy, otherwise known as time, space, and speed. And I'd look at you and say, Veronica, let's get logical here. All there has ever been is nothing. All there ever will be is nothing. Add nothing to nothing, and what do you get? Twice as much? Nothing. That's it. And all of a sudden, whammo. I mean, everything I'm saying makes perfect sense. You know, nothing in, nothing out.
Right.
The problem is, all of a sudden, whammo, there's a pinprick infinitesimally smaller than a pinprick, and it expands at a speed that is utterly beyond belief. And it turns out that what's expanding is this giant unfurling sheet, this giant rubber trampoline that just is on a growth bench. It's a time-space manifold. What? Time-space manifold? There's no such thing. There was no such thing as time. There was no such thing as space. Just a flick of nothingness ago. Where did
right.
these things come from? And then you make another one of your bizarre predictions, Veronica. You tell me that any 10 to the minus 32nd of a second now, any little tiny sliver of a second now, that rapidly unfolding sheet of space, time, and speed is going to precipitate the way that a rain cloud precipitates in a storm. It's going to precipitate into things. Now, Veronica, we really know you've lost it this time. You were lucky the first time. But why do you think the no thing is called the nothing? I mean, the nothing is called the no thing. Because there aren't any things. There never have been anything. There never will be anything. And let's use logic again. You're talking about adding space, time, and speed to space, time, and speed. Space, time, and speed in. Space, time, and speed out. That's all you're going to get is space, time, and speed. And whammo. Gazillions of particles come precipitating from this sheet, from the
right.
nowhere. How? Why? Not only that, but, you know, we're given the notion that we've been given it for the last, God knows, 200 years ever since probability theory was developed. We've been given the notion that we live in a probabilistic universe, that we live in a sort of random universe. We live in the famous six monkeys at six typewriters universe, where six monkeys sitting at six typewriters, occasionally accidentally banging a toe or an elbow against a typewriter key, will, if given all the time in the world, produce the works of Shakespeare. That's the standard idea of randomness. It doesn't work that way, because we've seen this sheet of space, time, and speed precipitate into gazillions and gazillions of things. Now, if this were a random universe, there should be gazillions and gazillions of different kinds of things. In fact, they should be so radically different from each other that there's no way in the world they could ever communicate or have anything in common. They should all have surprising, astonishing properties, whether it's tentacles coming from their noses or tufts of hair coming from their tuchuses or whatever it is. But that is not the way it works. There are only 400 different kinds of particles. Every single one of a given species is precisely identical to gazillions of others all across the universe. They've never communicated with each other. They've never tried to influence each other. But they're all precisely identical with gazillions of copies. Well, in a universe of gazillions of things, to have only 400 different kinds of particles in only 56 different species, that's not randomness. That's what we call in science a rigidly constrained universe. So what does this have to do with logic? Well, in logic, Aristotle says A equals A. Hey, I got news for you, Aristotle. A does not equal A. You know there are five heresies in the book. The five heresies are A does not equal A. 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. The second law of thermodynamics, that the law of entropy, that all things fall apart, that all things tumble downward, is absolutely and remarkably wrong. That randomness, as we've just been indicating, is not at all as random as you think, and that information theory is not really about information. In fact, it misses the point. So let's go back to A equals A. Protons are all, well, there aren't any protons. Those first things, by the way, Veronica, were quarks, and they were photons. And the quarks, another thing that's very relevant to this, meaning shows up at the very beginning of the universe. Meaning shows up because the universe is social, and the universe is into the kind of coupling that we discuss when we're talking about sexuality. I mean,
Definitely.
It really is big. It's big time into team making and into bonding and into permanent bonding, because a quark, which is the most basic, the most elementary particle, cannot live on its own. It can only exist if it gangs together with one or two other quarks. So there's this scramble at the very beginning of the universe. It's as if the quarks come with little etiquette books built into them. And a little set of rules built into them somehow tells them who they should avoid and who they should rush toward. And they rush away from the ones they should avoid. They rush toward the ones that are attractive to them. And they bond together. They bond together so solidly that some of the threesomes, one kind of threesome of two up quarks and a down quark, I think it is, here's another area where logic doesn't fit. Three quarks, put three quarks together, and Veronica, what by the rules of arithmetic and logic should you get?
Three quarks.
That's right, and any other notion that you would get anything else is obviously radically stupid.
But
when
not
three
logical.
Quarks... Yeah, when three quarks get together, what the hell happens? In the case of one kind of threesome, they become protons. In the case of another kind of threesome, they become neutrons. Well, the properties of protons and neutrons are so very, very far away from the properties of mere quarks that you wonder, how in the world did this come about? And then another strange thing happens. Those neutrons...
And by the way, Howard, when you take two things and put them together and come up with something completely different, that sounds like sexual reproduction to me.
It sounds like sexual reproduction, and it sounds like something else. I'm going to take a big jump for a minute before we go back to logic.
Okay.
The woman I date, approximately 3 months ago, said to me, "Why do men so undervalue sex?" And I thought, what? What is she talking about? We have sex in all of our advertising campaigns. If you show 100 men a picture of a sleek, new, shiny car, they will rate it only mediocre. But if they see a picture of the same car in the same pose with the same lighting with a pretty girl draped across the hood, all of a sudden they think it's faster, more powerful. I mean, sex is all over the place. So how can you possibly say that men devalue sex? Well, she's right. We somehow trivialize it. Sex is one of those portals to the transcendent. Sex gets you, not all sex is like this, I'm sure, but when sex works, it takes you out of yourself. It removes you from everyday life. It takes you to something higher or more intense or more something than your everyday self. And
it can be the doorway to the divine.
Yeah, Exactly.
That's the way the ancients looked at it.
Well, it's true. And so she was dead right, because men, when they, you know, they go out to hook up with a girl on a Friday night, and they find a willing woman, and the two of them have a lot to drink, and they go and they boink. And he gets all upset, he has commitment panic, and wonders what the hell he did, and tries to sneak out, or usually does, at 4 o'clock in the morning. What has he just done? He's just thrown away his doorway to enchantment. He's just thrown away his doorway to a tiny little slice of paradise, to a kind of joy that's normally inaccessible in everyday life. What does this have to do with quarks getting together and logic? Well, when three quarks get together, they make something totally, unbelievably beyond quarkdom, and that is the proton or the neutron. And on occasion, when sexuality is really good, and it's not always really good because relationships are terribly difficult things, but when sexuality is really good, whammo, it takes you to a form of joy that you would never imagine in your daily life. And now this ability to put a couple of things together and get something that's so radically different that it defies all forms of prediction. It happens in sexuality. It happens in physics with quarks. These are called emergent properties. And the mystery of emergent properties...
Say the word again. What kind of properties?
It's emergent properties.
Emerging properties.
Yeah, emerging from something. And the idea of emergent properties came up in 1835. There was a kid who had written a short story and a poem, and he was very ambitious, and he sent his short story and his poem to every editor and person of literary talent he could possibly find. And one of the people he sent it to was a guy named Leigh Hunt. Now, Leigh Hunt had introduced Percy Bysshe Shelley to Keats, a big thing in the history of poetry, mm-hmm. and had mm-hmm. actually co-founded a magazine with Lord Byron. So he had been in some august company. He'd also written a poem called Abu Ben Adam. Abu Ben Adam, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace, I think it goes. You've probably heard that since you were a child. Leigh Hunt wrote that. Okay, so Leigh Hunt took this kid under his arm and wanted to introduce him to one of the greatest social commentators of the 19th century, Thomas Carlyle. And he took this kid over to Thomas Carlyle's house, and they discovered Thomas Carlyle was standing there in his living room, and then there was somebody else on the couch, and the person on the couch was crying his eyes off. He was having one of the most extreme fits of misery you have ever seen, tears all over the place. Well, it turned out that the person on the couch was John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill had fallen in love with the French Revolution. Thomas Carlyle was writing a book about the French Revolution. John Stuart Mill borrowed the manuscript of the book. Now, Veronica, in those days, you didn't have copies. No, you couldn't do backup copies. There was no Carbonite. There was no Dropbox. Your handwritten manuscript was it, the only manuscript you had. Well, when John Stuart Mill took this manuscript home, he somehow burned it to a crisp. Those were the days of open flames and candles and fireplaces. And he was so appalled by what he had done that all he could do was lay on the couch and cry. And Thomas Carlyle, who was normally a grouchy man, seemed to be trying to soothe him, very unlike Thomas Carlyle. So that's how John Stuart Mill and George Henry Luce, the 17-year-old kid, met. And they, in 1835, realized something. This gas called oxygen had been discovered about 50 years earlier. And another gas called hydrogen had been discovered about 50 years earlier. And 30 years earlier, it had been discovered that water was made out of hydrogen and oxygen. Now, at some point, which I haven't been able to track historically, somebody else came to another conclusion. But we'll skip the conclusion for a second to tell you the experiment. What George Henry Luce and John Stuart Mill were contemplating was this. If you take a bell jar filled with oxygen, it's just a gas, right? You can see through it. You can put your hand through it. If you put it into the bell jar, it's just like the gas we breathe every day. It just has slightly different properties. And if you took a bell jar filled with hydrogen, same thing. You can see through it. You can put your hand through it. It seems as if it's not there. So if you take one jar of oxygen and one bell jar of hydrogen, and you put them together, what should you get, especially according to the rule of 1 plus 1 equals 2? Well, go ahead. What do you get? You should get a gas. That's the logical thing. You take two gases, you put them together, and you get a gas. Yeah. Gas in, gas out, right?
Right.
Now, supposing you light a match, and you put the match into the bell jar with the hydrogen and the oxygen. What should you get? Well, all you've done is add a little bit of heat. So you should get a slightly hotter gas, right? Make sense?
One plus one equals two, A equals A.
Yes, unfortunately, it produces two very surprising things. An explosion, there goes your bell jar, and there goes your eyes if you don't shield yourself carefully. It produces an explosion and this really weird form of matter. It's you can touch it with your fingers the way that you can touch the table, but your finger can go through it. But it's not a gas. It sort of sticks to your finger. You can feel it in a way that you can't feel a gas. Plus, if it falls off the table, it will soak into the rug, or it will soak into your pants. It has radically different properties from mere matter or mere gas. It's called a liquid, and its name is water. What?
Yeah.
How the hell do you get this bizarre substance, a liquid, from two gases and a little bit of heat?
H2O.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense. I mean, all of this is a relatively new discovery. So they're sitting around trying to figure out what to do with this observation. It doesn't fit any of the mathematics that they know, and it doesn't fit any of the science that they know. So they each come up with names for it. John Stuart Mill's name never takes off. It's too complicated for me even to remember. George Henry Luce comes up with this name, emergence, and that name sticks. It's been with us for 175 years or so.
And this also describes what happens to water when it becomes ice, right? Because that's
Exactly. Phase transitions, that's called. So the big question that they raised, and they put it very bluntly, was we cannot describe this with mathematics. That means it's a challenge to math. Math has to come up to the challenge. Well, in the 135 or 145 years since then, has math come up to the challenge?
No,
it hasn't. It's ignored the challenge. Now, science is about observing absolutely as much as you possibly can, looking for the biggest mysteries and puzzles around, and then tackling them. Because science people have this hidden aspiration to omniscience. We want to be like gods. We want to understand everything. Now, of course, we can't understand everything, but the higher you shoot, the higher you go. It pays sometimes to shoot for the impossible. And sometimes you actually reach a few impossible things along the way. But science has not been shooting for this particular impossibility. There was a very big movement of emergence in the intellectual community in the 1920s and 1930s, and then it went away, and it was forgotten. Today, there is a mathematician and physicist named Paul Davies down at the University of Arizona, and he's busy trying to push the concept of emergence back into the scientific culture. But this book traces the history of our logic, which fails to cope with emergence. It traces the history of our math, which is a far more exciting history than you would think. I mean, it's really bizarre. It's like something from an alien planet. And it traces the history of how we got the math that we have today, which shows you that the math we have today is very provisional. It's just very recent. I mean, it's a fashion. It's a 350-year fashion and a fad. And we're about to go beyond it. And it shows you how we're about to go beyond it, how we're about to be able to trip into the realm of emergence and all of the magic and sorcery that emergence implies.
As in you believe... Oh, okay, so... I understand, and this is a quote actually from your book, you said, we have vastly underrated the cosmos that gave us birth. And did you just say that you're anticipating that we are going to be moving into an evolutionary period where there will actually be access to things that we used to consider magical?
Well, yes, because remember, alchemy turned into chemistry. And I'm not saying that we're going to be wizards in the old sense of the word, but we are going to be wizards. We are wizards today compared to what we were 150 years ago. Look what we've accomplished between 150 years ago and now. In 1850, if you and I had been born back then, we would have had a life expectancy of 38.5 years. If we'd been born in 2000, it would have been 78.5 years. That's a doubling of the human lifespan. And now Chinese emperors used to spend every bit of cash they could get their hands on and all kinds of precious goods to hire wizards of all kinds and alchemists to lengthen their lives. And often, those wizards and alchemists shortened their lives by giving them things that were filled with mercury and other poisons. We have doubled the human lifespan. That's a kind of sorcery the Chinese could not buy, no matter how hard they tried. If we'd been born, if we'd been the poorest paid workers in London in 1850, we would have been Irish dock workers. And if we had been the poorest paid workers in London in 2007, we would have been personal assistants. Well, guess what? A personal assistant in London in 2007 earned as much as an entire tenement full of dock workers earned back in 1850. Plus, she could buy things those tenement workers could never dream of, like the cell phones that we've got, like the connection between you. Where are you now? In California?
Yep. And where are you?
Okay, and here I am in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And we are talking to each other. I'm sorry, in 1850, the notion that that could ever happen would have been a ludicrous, ludicrous dream. So things have changed.
So Howard, a lot of that is because of the technology, which continues to develop. But I have a question for you. Do you think that since you know, if going on the premise that the universe is not actually conforming to mathematical formulas, it's not actually conforming to logic as we know it, which is A equals A, what about the whole idea? Now, you talked about entropy, where, you know, there's a gradual deterioration, and I want to pursue that a little bit more. But before we get into that, what about the whole idea that some of these basic mechanisms that caused the universe to operate could also be evolving or changing?
Well, they are evolving and changing in the following sense. Protons have remained the same. Remember, those quarks that got together into protons? If you try to put your hand, your right finger, right index finger, through your left hand, through your palm, it won't go through, right?
Right.
And because you're solid. And what makes you solid? Well, protons to a large extent. Protons holding atoms together. And how old are those protons? Well, they go back to that first flick, micro flick of the universe, the first 10 to the minus 30 seconds of the universe we were talking about. So now, is the stuff that makes you solid a part of you, Veronica?
Well, that's a good question, Howard.
And, well, if it is a part of you, then you have two birthdays. You have the birthday in which you were born as a human being, but you have the birthday in which the matter of which you are made was born, and that's 13.72 billion years ago. So you really have a pedigree that goes all the way back to the Big Bang. The Big Bang was your father and your mother, and your Big Bang was my father and my mother, too. Wait, what was the question again? I've lost it.
Well, is it possible that some of the basic things you're saying, that protons have not changed their characteristics in billions of years? So that is a partial answer to my question.
I remember the rest of the question. Okay, those protons have stayed the same, but are you the same as the stuff that was around this universe 4 billion years ago before life began? Not by a long shot.
I'm not even the same as 7 years ago, because I think we change our cells out every 7 years.
Well, we change not only that, but every minute while we're talking. Every minute, 3 billion cells in your bloodstream are swapped in and out. A billion neural receptors in your brain are changed, and an equal number, roughly, of cells in your gut and cells in your skin are being changed. So. But that's a big subject of the God problem. What is identity? And the God problem shows you that, but I should answer your question first, because I want to go into the wave and the miracle of what a wave is. But the point is that you take the same elements and you put them in a different location and you put them in a different set of social relationships with different emergent properties, and everything changes, no matter how much those A's stay the same. Yes, protons have stayed the same the way that A equals A. But A does not equal A. A protein in your hand is doing a very different job than a protein in your laptop. A proton in the sea is doing a very different job than a proton in your brain. And context counts. I mean, just to show you how A can differ from A, there are two A's in the word Shakespeare. They don't even sound the same. They don't have similar meanings at all. One is part of a verb, something that means grabbing hold of something and moving it back and forth or up and down. That's shake. And the other word is something that you would pick up. It's a long rod with a sharp tip that you could pick up and shake. That's a spear. Well, those two A's, they don't sound alike. They don't have the same meaning. They don't participate in the same thing at all. Take that up to the level of the protons in you, me, the phones we're talking on, and the laptops in front of our eyes. And every proton is participating in a vastly different kind of team. And teamwork, where you fit in a team, context, means everything. Meaning, where you fit in a team and how you're interpreted, means everything. So that's that question. Yes, things stay the same, and yes, they change because emergent properties keep emerging. And yes, there are violent jumps, huge jumps in the way the cosmos evolves. That jump from nothing to the first microflick, from nothing to the first pinprick smaller than a pinprick, that was a giant jump. The jump from the pinprick smaller than a pinprick to an unfurling sheet of space, time, and energy, that was an astonishing, unbelievable, unpredictable jump. And the precipitation of quarks from a sheet of space and time, my God, what an unpredictable jump. If we've had unpredictable jumps, I could trace the whole history of the cosmos for you, but that would take us a couple of hours to show you. But I could show you these stunning, unbelievable, shockingly, shatteringly, screamingly surprising jumps at every stage of the universe's evolution. Now, do you think the universe has stopped evolving? And if it hasn't stopped evolving, then what the hell are the next giant shocks and surprises? Because they are going to come. That's the way the universe operates. That's why entropy is so very wrong.
Howard, this is one of the things that fascinates me, actually, about scientists. I was interviewing a primatologist last year, and chimpanzees had just, not all of them, just certain tribes in the Congo had invented the use of spears to fish out bush babies that are stuck in the branches and trees. So I asked this primatologist, how long do you think before the chimpanzees figure out that they can use those spears on each other? Because Jane Goodall has documented war in chimpanzees the last 4 years. And this primatologist says, oh, that'll never happen. And I thought, what? Did I miss the memo that we're not evolving anymore?
Right. Well, the chimps evolve a lot less rapidly than we do. There's a concept in some of my books of group IQ. And, the modern science has tended, especially evolutionary biology, has tended to focus on the individual and not think of the larger group and think that the individual is only out for his own sake. But in reality, when individuals work in teams, the structure of the team can make all the difference in the world to their collective brain power. So you have groups of chimpanzees in Africa, and you have groups of baboons. And between the baboons and the chimpanzees, guess who has the biggest brain? It's the chimpanzee, who's related to us, who's 99.5% of its DNA, depending on who's doing the counting, is related to ours. But who's smarter? Well, how do we measure smartness of those baboons and chimpanzees? Jane Goodall has to go on television all the time begging for money to save the habitat of the chimpanzees, which means that if the habitat changes, the chimpanzees cannot adjust. Have you ever seen anybody begging for money to save the baboons? No,
no,
not at all. The reason is because the baboons are considered the rats of Africa, and they're considered the rats of Africa because it doesn't matter what challenge you throw at them, it doesn't matter what change in the environment you throw at them, they can figure out a way to take advantage of it.
Howard, if that's how we measure intelligence, the human being loses to the cockroach every time.
Well, not really, because we can do things like invent. Cockroaches don't build anything. Now, lots of other animals do, but cockroaches don't. And when insects do build things, the way that bees build their hives and the way that termites build these astonishing palaces, these mega cities, they don't change. They don't adapt. But we adapt every generation. We sometimes adapt three times in a generation. We have technology. We have brains that are much, much more flexible than theirs. But the point is that no brain exists in an island. The reason that the baboons are smarter than the chimps is because the baboons network with each other far more effectively. They exchange information far more effectively. So they may have the smaller individual brains, but they have the larger group smarts. They also are more curious. Their youngsters, especially, are more curious. And that means, and what does that mean to us humans? Well, we talk about the wisdom of indigenous tribes all of the time. Indigenous tribes do not have the wisdom of giant civilizations. They don't have the wisdom because they don't have the hundreds of millions of brains to tap that are tapped in a large-scale civilization. They're not as smart. They're not as nimble. Yes, there's no such thing as a human. I mean, there is no such thing as a human whose knowledge base is not useful to you and me. Every human has a perspective that can be useful to all of us. But it's modern societies that are nimble and quick and constantly inventing new things because they engage more brains, and they engage more brains in a whole set of cross-currents of forms of social organization, and the forms of social organization are these emergent properties that take on a life of their own.
Well, let's talk a little bit about entropy, because most people are going under the assumption that the universe is deteriorating and that the galaxies are spreading further and further apart in it, and that at some point the whole system is going to disintegrate. Now, if you don't believe in entropy, then you must have a different theory.
Well, I have two different theories. One is the thing called the Big Bagel, which comes at the very end of the God problem. And it's a new theory of the beginning, middle, and end of the universe, and that includes the end of the universe, that explains two giant mysteries in cosmology and theoretical physics. One mystery is, if matter and antimatter are created in equal amounts at the same time, where's all the antimatter? How come we have so much matter in this universe and so little antimatter? And the other big puzzle is, what is dark energy? You know that in 1998, a bunch of astronomers won Nobel Prizes for discovering that at a certain point, the galaxies in the universe, instead of just separating from each other the way we thought they were in an expanding universe, begin to sprint like hell to get away from each other. They begin to accelerate as if they were drivers of a Porsche putting his foot down on the pedal, the gas pedal, all the way. And we wondered, where in the world is the energy coming from for this acceleration? Well, Big Bagel explains it for the first time. And but Big Bagel also tends to imply that the universe may end in about a billion years. But if the universe ends in a billion years, that gives us a challenge. How do we squeeze everything that we know through a tiny little black hole to the beginning of the next universe? That's a major challenge. Now, have we overcome challenges like that in the past? You bet. We have conquered so many impossible challenges that it's absolutely ridiculous. We dreamt of flying back in the days of Daedalus and Icarus. You know, the story of Daedalus making the wax wings and Icarus flying too close to the sun and the wax melted. Well, that's 2,800 years ago. Carl Sagan thought that we've dreamt of flying since we first became human. And for most of the human span on this planet, the idea was absurd. It was ridiculous.
Jealous of the birds, if nothing else. But
yes.
So what about when we're thinking about how the universe works? Recently, they started talking about the quantum mechanics, and in particular, I'm thinking about the observer effect. That seems to be a theoretical foundation that actually is pretty controversial, and I'm wondering how you feel about it.
Well, in 2006 or 2005, I had written a paper with a collaborator at the Keldysh Institute of Applied Mathematics of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and it had gotten published in Arxiv.org, which is a leading preprint. It is the leading preprint site for advanced mathematics and theoretical physics. And we were invited to do a presentation at a conference of theoretical physicists, an international conference in Moscow. And I went and told an assembled mass of theoretical physicists from all over the world that everything they knew in theoretical physics was wrong, that the that theoretical physics is based on the idea, or that quantum physics, not everything in theoretical physics, but everything in quantum physics, because quantum physics is based on what I saw these guys doing during the entire 4 days of this convention, drawing pictures on napkins of a lone particle making it through the two-slit experiment. The big mistake there was there is no such thing as a lone particle. Particles are social. You know, we were talking about the sociality of quarks a little while ago, and we talked about how those quarks needed to get together in groups of three, and once they got together in groups of three, they formed protons and neutrons. Well, a neutron is so powerfully social, Veronica, that if it doesn't find a partner in 10.6 minutes, it disintegrates. How can you get anything more social than that? And that's the first flick of the universe's existence. If sociality was already apparent, not just apparent, it was absolute imperative back then, what do you think's happened to sociality since then? So is there such thing as a lone and undetected particle? Is there such thing as a particle that's not being in some peculiar way observed by other particles? No. Okay, now you can say, Bloom, that's anthropomorphism. Particles can't observe each other. Well, I got news for you. What were those quarks doing at the beginning of the cosmos when they were checking each other out to see whether they should run away or whether they should embrace?
What were they doing?
They were registering each other's signals in some way. They were registering each other's meaning, and so, or they were taking each other's signals and turning them into meaning. And what does registering a signal and turning it into meaning mean? I mean, isn't that spooky stuff you can't see? No, it's not spooky stuff you can't see. If a particle doesn't like what it sees, it runs away. That's called repulsion. If a particle likes what it sees and is attracted, it rushes toward what it's attracted toward. You can read its reading of whether something's attractive or repulsive by which direction it moves. It's as simple as that. So we have, we have actually what B.F. Skinner, the god of psychology of the 1950s, who believed that the mind doesn't exist. He said you have to reduce everything to stimulus and response. Guess what? We have stimulus and response in the very first flick of the cosmos' existence. So I'm not saying that these particles think. They don't. They don't have brains, they don't imagine, they don't do any of the things that we do, but they do respond to stimuli with a response, the response of running away or the response of running together. And what does it have to do with sexuality? Everything.
Absolutely everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now let's bring this home here, because the whole thing is that there's a problem with God. And I think a lot of the things that you're explaining here, from the quarks that are social to just something that starts to sound like there's kind of some intelligence behind the way the universe works, that it's not all just mechanical and chemical or mathematical. It makes leaps and jumps, and some people might think that indicated that the universe had an intelligence to it that was godlike.
Well, here's the big trick. In the same way that people in my community, the science community, have failed to look at basic assumptions like A equals A and 1 plus 1 equals 2, people in the creationist community fail to look at a basic assumption involved in their belief system. And that is, what is creation? What do we mean by creating? What do we mean by designing? What do we mean by an intelligence? What we really mean is this. The human brain is rigged for far more vision than most of our fellow animals. Most of our fellow animals put a greater reliance in what they can pick up with their noses and in chemical signals. We put our reliance into visual signals. And as a consequence, at least according to Ramachandran, we have approximately 30 visual centers in the brain. That's a very heavily visually committed brain. So when we're talking about creating something, what we're talking about is using those 30 visual centers to come up with a picture of something. And then, having come up with a picture, to put together a mechanism, a device, a contrivance, a Google, a gadget, that will do what we've imagined. Well, that's a peculiarly human way of doing things. And just because we come up with visions first and then come up with something that we make that fits the vision doesn't mean that the universe operates that way. The universe doesn't have a brain, unless, of course, there is a God, in which case everything that I'm saying about how the cosmos creates itself is telling you about the language of God. It's telling you about how God does his or her creative operations, in which case the book is still of use to you. But one way or the other, I don't believe that there's something as silly as a giant intelligence having to pre-plan these things. And one of the things that we've learned about pre-planning is how limited it is. A seed, there's a big difference between a seed and a Model T. A Model T you make part by part by part. You build the parts separately from each other. Then you put them together according to a previously arrived at plan. And finally, you get a Model T. A seed is not like that at all. A seed somehow includes within it the blueprint for its entire future. Put it in the ground, water it, and it will start as a shoot, and from a shoot it will become a young plant, and from a young plant it will become a mature plant, and it will develop all kinds of strange things like stems and leaves, and all of these things will grow organically together at the same time. Now, with some creatures, with some living things, you can take a piece of a living thing, and you can cultivate it in the right way, and it'll become an entirely separate, totally complete living thing. But try taking a cog out of a machine. Try taking a spark plug out of a Model T. Put it in a petri dish. Let it sit there for as long as it likes. Give it the right temperature. Yeah, well, you end up with a Model T. So there's a dramatic difference between the way the universe goes about creating and the way we go about creating. And we are looking in the mirror and projecting ourselves into the universe when we talk about the need for an intelligence and the need for a designer. But in fact, that is just showing how limited we are, because we have not yet learned how to create things that will unfold the way that things unfold in nature. Until we learn that, we really we don't know what's going on in this universe. We need to break free of the traditional ways of doing logic, recognize that emergence is there, recognize that it's a major challenge, and then tackle it with all our might.
So, Howard, you said that it's possible that people who believe in God would actually find your book useful as well. Say more about that, if you will, because I think the basic premise of your book is there is no God. But for people who would believe in a God, what would they find of value in your book?
The basic premise of the book is I don't believe in God, but that doesn't mean you don't have to believe in God. This is very different than Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens. They are telling you that religion is the source of all evil in the world and that we should exterminate it. I believe that's a terribly intolerant point of view, that many points of view have to coexist simultaneously, and that and I can respect you if you believe in religion, and you can respect me if I don't. But when I went back to study the history of the God problem is the question of how a cosmos without a God, without a creator, without an intelligence, without a designer, how a universe creates itself. And I went back to, I was sure that Galileo and Newton and Kepler, the guys who founded modern science, had their own way of expressing this problem, and I discovered something remarkable. They were all creationists. They all believed in the creation of the earth and the cosmos in 7 days, the way it says in the Bible. Now, they believed in stripe-like variations. Galileo said that basically the scriptures have certain distortions because God was trying to get across the message to the relatively unintelligent, humblest among us, and as a consequence had a fudge. But what Galileo said is God speaks, and he speaks to us in the language of nature, that words may fudge, but nature cannot. Nature must follow God's words down to the last detail. So if you really want to know God's thinking process, if you really want to know God's laws, look at nature. And Kepler and Newton all felt the same way. Even Einstein felt the same way. He was a sort of fuzzy religionist because he didn't have the God. His God was not a bearded guy with a bathrobe in the sky. But he called his God Leibniz's God, which meant nature was God itself. Nature and God were inseparable for him. But he felt that what he was doing by trying to find the underlying geometry and the magic of the universe, the missing something, he called it, was tracking the mind of God, reading the mind of God. So what I'm doing is basically reading the mind of God. I'm trying to show you, if there were a God, this is how he operates in the real world, or how she operates in the real world. In some ways, it's bloody, nasty, terrible, vicious. You alluded to that in the piece that you wrote today. In some ways, it is morally reprehensible. In fact, it's morally unacceptable. If there is a God, then she or he is the biggest mass murderer in the history of anything, because almost everything that's ever been born dies. And that includes stars. And that means trillions and trillions of things have died in the 13.72 billion years of this universe's existence. Is that morally acceptable? Not at all. Not one bit. So if there is a God, she has made us with something brand new. And that's a conscience, a moral sensibility, compassion, the feeling that warmth and justice are two things that should rule. She has given us the ability to imagine a universe that is kinder, more compassionate, and more just. And it's our job to execute that dream. It's our job to turn this universe from mass murder and suffering to creativity that excels the creativity the universe has had so far, which is not easy. This has been an incredibly creative place, but does it without mass murder.
Well, Howard, I like that. No. Because I don't think that everything that exists in the natural world is something that I have to embrace. I mean, you know, it kind of annoys me actually when, oh, but that's nature, and it's like, yeah, well, nature's kind of screwed up sometimes.
Well, remember when you 15 years ago, you were attacked for what you were doing, and who was attacking you? Other creatures made by nature. They're human beings. But there are other creatures made by nature. And if you look at the chimpanzees that you were talking about before, Jane Goodall observed, they were nasty, mean, and vicious to each other, even before she discovered war among the chimps. And she didn't discover that till she'd been at Gombe for 20 years. Even before that, she saw male chimps ripping the testicles off of other chimps, breaking others' arms, using all of their weight, and these beasts weigh quite a bit and are very muscular, using all their weight and jumping up and down and breaking bones on others. That's nature. That's one manifestation of nature. And it's our job, since we don't like it, and since we can imagine something beyond it, to get beyond it. Can we get beyond it? Is that a silly dream? Yeah, it's a silly dream, like Leonardo da Vinci drawing flying machines. 500 years ago. It was silly for his time, but because people persisted in it generation after generation after generation, it was a dream that came true. And the dream of peace, the dream of turning our swords into into plowshares and our spears into pruning hooks, it's a dream that's been with us for a long time. The fact that we won't achieve it in our generation doesn't matter. We have to keep pushing, because if we keep pushing, somewhere down the line, other generations will succeed in making the 747 a piece, the equivalent to the flying machine that takes you across the country for $300.
Well, Howard, you brought us full circle, because we're right back at sex, because the bonobos, who are the close cousins of the chimpanzees, are not violent like they are, and they use sex to glue their social structure together and to ameliorate some of their stresses and aggressions. And I think that's the direction for humans to go into. I also think you brought us back to love, which is perhaps something I think humans are most interested in, whether it is having that peak sexual experience that makes you feel closer to something other than yourself, or if it's the sacrifices that we make for one another and you know, that social bonding that you talk about with the most elemental parts of the universe is certainly something that comes out and shines in the human being in their better moments.
Well, I love, you know, I was reading some of your writing today, and I suddenly realized, love, I haven't been thinking about that. I have. I've got the equivalent of 3 books worth of material of writing about it. But I haven't been thinking about it in the terms that you were thinking about it. And it is a huge mystery, because in reality, the relationships that come out of love end up being tense and difficult and have their explosive moments, and no relationship is, I have a friend in L.A. that I talk to every week, and he claims that his wife is absolutely angelic and that they have a wonderful time together every single week and never have any difficulties. I don't know whether I should believe him, Veronica, because love relationships are difficult. And yet, there are moments when we are, you know, you walk up to a friend you haven't seen for a long time and give that person a hug. There are certain people that you've known for 10 years or 15 years or longer who will just never cease to be an important part of your life. There are certain people you get proud of for everything that they do that succeeds. And yet, there are always jealousies, even of the people that we love the most, and always little conflicts, even of the people we love all the most. So, love is a tricky one, and you know that's got its, you know this better than anybody. It's got its hormonal components, oxytocin, prolactin, stuff like that. So it's a big mystery, and I don't know if my lifetime is going to be long enough to ever go to those three volumes of notes in my book and write something about it.
Well, if you do write your book about love, I want you back here to talk about it, that's for sure. But right now, we're running out of time, and I want to make sure the listeners know how to get a copy of The God Problem. So maybe you want to share your website and the best place to find a copy of your book.
Well, the easiest way to get a copy of The God Problem is to go to Amazon.com. You can go to my website. It's howardbloom.net. That's howardbloom.net. And that should take care of you. Plus, there's a big page on the Big Bagel Theory on howardbloom.net and quite a bit of other stuff that's interesting.
Well, Howard, it's always a pleasure. Love connecting with you. You always get my brain spinning out in a lot of different directions. And
Thanks.
Sorry.
Thanks for being in my life for the last God knows how many years.
Oh, you're welcome, Howard. It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. All right. Well, unfortunately, we are going to have to sign off. It just came up 10 o'clock. So thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And again, this has been an interview with Howard Bloom. And his new book is The God Problem. I hope you go out and get a copy.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mentus kabar berita?